This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments podcast for the week of July 14th, 2014. This podcast is presented by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CPA Incorporated. Any use of the materials with this podcast or the audio without the written consent of your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CPA Inc. is prohibited. This podcast is copyright 2014 Nichols Patrick CPE Incorporated. We're going to take a look at what went on this week and the week following the 4th of July holiday. And frankly, not a whole lot happened this week, but there were some items that are interesting. And so we'll discuss this week six different developments that took place during the week. And we're going to start with a tax court case. The case in this situation is a case of Hume and Delana versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2014-135. This case involved the question of whether or not the taxpayers were in a trade or business related to real property that they had purchased. In this particular case, the taxpayers had bought property in San Clemente, California, that was of minor historic significance. The home had been constructed for Oscar-nominated actress Anne Harding in 1926. And they thought they could use that bit of minor celebrity to rent this out for various weekly vacation and events for people coming there. Now, when they bought this house, they discovered there were people living in it who had been leasing at a rather low rate. They kicked them out and then took a look toward improving the property to make it available for rent. Turns out the property had a lot of problems, and in fact, never did they actually end up renting it out to any party. In fact, what ended up happening was eventually the marriage went south and the husband began living in this property rather than the family home whenever he was out of town. Now, the question that arose at this point was a question of whether or not in later years after this was a few years after they had acquired the home, they were deducting and claiming a deduction for the interest expense on, of all places, Schedule C. Now, we get into a long discussion about whether being a rental, it should have been on E anyway, but that's not really relevant because whether it should go on C or E, it only can get there if, in fact, this property is not a personal use property. And in this case, the tax court began judging this under the question of, since they put it on Schedule C, whether it was a trade or business. And what they determined was, in order to decide if the trade or business of renting the property had actually was being undertaken in the year in question, the tax court said we needed to look at three major criteria. The first criteria was, did they undertake the activity with the intention of making a profit? The court decided on this point that the answer was yes. They had a clear intention based on their testimony, and there was no evidence to suggest this was not the case, that when they purchased the property in San Clemente, they were planning to rent it out and use it as a profit-making activity. So the court found that, in fact, it was undertaken with profit activity, but there's still two other hurdles to clear. Second, was the taxpayer regularly and actively involved in the activity? The court in this case kind of decided in many ways, to be quite honest, that it was not going to have to decide. So it decided to grant that it was plausible to look at what they had done over the years and decide that they had been involved regularly and actively in the activities related to this property. But the court found a problem on the third test. Has the taxpayer's activity actually commenced? This was where the court found there was a major problem for the taxpayers, which they could not overcome. The court found the taxpayers fell short of the standard, and frankly, it's why they weren't concerned with the second one. The court eventually decided that one real problem was there were a few problems with deciding if they had started. It was clear by the year in question, and this was 2008 and 2009, they'd purchased it back in 2005, that in fact the property was now being used by the taxpayer to live in, so that they felt that there was no activity going underway in the years in question. The court decided it didn't actually rule that there never had been a rental activity and that rental activities never would have been allowable, but it rather decided that even if there had been such activities, the taxpayers had clearly abandoned those activities by the time we got to the year in questions for 2008 and 2009. For this reason, the court found that the taxpayers could not deduct the interest on the front page of the return as an above-the-line deduction, but at best, it was going to be deductible as home mortgage interest. that was going to prove to be a problem for the taxpayers, because while it was used as a residence by the taxpayers, they had real issues and problems that they were soaring well past the $1 million limitation on acquisition debt that was available for taxpayers. So in this case, effectively, the taxpayers did not get a deduction for this particular activity. The key takeaway for practitioners is to remember that merely having good intentions when you buy something will not last forever. In this case, those intentions from 2005, the court decided by 8 and 9 it wasn't going to buy in on the good intentions business any longer. It was looking at what the property actually got used for, and it decided that early on, effectively, the taxpayers must have decided to abandon this rental activity, and therefore no deduction would be allowed above the line. Too often what we find with tax practices, there's a real tendency to just look at whatever we did last year. And in this scenario, clearly we have to understand that each year stands on its own, and you have to evaluate each year whether or not an activity, especially one like this where they never actually seem to get it off the ground, is still truly being conducted as a trade or business activity. And obviously, once the taxpayer began using it as his principal residence, there were serious doubts about the fact as to whether this could plausibly be taken on Schedule A. Next tax court case we're going to look at is the case of Dickinson versus Commissioner. This is Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2014-136. This is a case of whether we have an actual bona fide debt where a taxpayer tried to claim a trade or business bad debt. Mr. Dickinson was opening up and starting his consulting business. And he knew somebody who he had previously worked with in another location that he had been involved in the same business. And he knew this particular gentleman was somebody who he felt was going to be good and help him build his business. Now, this particular gentleman, it turns out, had a couple of problems. He had gone through a divorce. He owed child support. He owed other payments to his former spouse. And he had had significant financial difficulties in recent years. In essence, he wasn't keeping up on paying not only the child support, his payments to his ex-spouse, but was having trouble keeping up with paying anything. So Mr. Dickinson decided, he asked this guy to come work for him, and he turned around and advanced this particular person money. This particular time he did this, he was aware of the fact that this gentleman was in severe financial difficulty. Nevertheless, he did not have the gentleman sign a promissory note. He did not have the gentleman go ahead and pledge any collateral. There was no schedule of repayments provided for this advance that he gave him, and there was no interest ever charged on this loan. Rather, it just kind of sat out there. Mr. Dickinson claimed in a letter to this gentleman that this was his normal practice and he always acted informally in such occasions, and that they were going to continue the same activity with this guy. Well, it turns out, at least this Mr. Dickinson alleged, that his employee, who now had access to a couple of bank accounts, turns out that maybe the money he'd been advanced wasn't quite enough, so he took some money from the other accounts. It was never clear if Mr. Dickinson was aware of this or not, although he kept him on for quite a while after this money started disappearing from the account. So we could assume that Mr. Dickinson either wasn't paying a lot of attention to the account, or Mr. Dickinson was aware this gentleman was taking funds from the account. A few years went by, there was a falling out between the parties after they had actually ramped up and formed a partnership at one point. But then there was a falling out, and Mr. Dickinson turned around and attempted to collect this balances that had been advanced to his employee by going to court. The particular case in question, the year in question for the tax return was 2007. On the 2007 return, Mr. Dickinson claimed a bad debt deduction. Now, this was interesting because the court case against his employee, and by the way, there was a counterclaim by the employee back against Mr. Dickinson, claimed that none of this had meant to be a loan, and so we had this dispute in court. At the end of 2007, that dispute was still before the court. And it was not until 2009 that the court dismissed the lawsuit, and in essence, Mr. Dickinson was therefore, you know, had lost his right to pursue any collection. Now, Mr. Dickinson, of course, was claiming a bad debt, and this was actually a bad debt that was around half of what his fees that he earned for the year from his consulting would be reported on the Schedule C, so it was fairly significant. And he realized that, so he wrote a nice long note to the IRS as part of the return explaining all of the sad story he had and how he tried to work this out and how he was now giving up and it was just an expensive lesson. Well, the lesson was going to get a little more expensive when it turns out that the IRS was going to come out and decide that his taxes had been understated by this bad debt. The IRS claim was that he had not demonstrated all the key factors necessary to show that this was a bad debt. In fact, the IRS position was, frankly, he hadn't demonstrated anything. He had failed to show it was a bona fide bad debt. He had failed to show if it was a debt that it was uncollectible at the end of 2007. And he failed to show that essentially it related to the trader business. Well, the tax court took a look at this and really said we can pretty much decide this by only looking at the question of whether it was a bona fide bad debt. Mr. Dickinson claimed that it was his usual practice to make these loans with no documentation, no security, no repayment schedule, and charge no interest. The court said that's fine, but the only evidence we have of this is your testimony telling us this is what you do. It's clear the court would have felt much better had Mr. Dickinson actually produced other people who would have come up and testified that they had borrowed money from Mr. Dickinson under these terms and had actually repaid the loans, because the court noted that this employee never paid interest or any principal. He never paid anything on these advances. He simply held on to them. The next catch problem was they said, well, look, they also said, okay, we don't know this is your general practice. Now we take a look at the general objective factors that indicate there's a valid loan. And they said, in this case, we have some problems seeing this as an actual debt. There's no signed promissory note. There was no interest ever collected. There was no repayment schedule on the loans. There was no collateral pledge for the loans. And there was never any amounts repaid. The court finally, and probably most significantly, said, given the financial difficulties of the employee at the time the loan was made, we simply do not believe that you had any reasonable expectation of being repaid the note. With no reasonable expectation of repayment, you don't have a debt. Without a debt, you don't have a bad debt. Therefore, the court denied the bad debt deduction to Mr. Dickinson in this case and upheld the IRS's assessment of tax against him. Next, we move out to some actually withdrawal of regulations that was announced on July 10th of this week. This is the withdrawal of the proposed regulations related to IRA rollovers at REG-2009-459-78. This withdraws regulations that were actually released back in the 1980s that dealt with issues related to whether or not how one handled rollovers from IRA accounts. In fact, these regulations were published in 1981. So the proposed regulations had been sitting there for 33 years. Now, these proposed regulations are important because they held for a position that the tax court, in the case of Bobrow versus Commissioner back in January, TC Memo 2014-21, had held was not a valid interpretation of the law. And they held that at the IRS's insistence. The catch was they never mentioned these proposed regs. Those of you who forget the Bobrow case. The Bobrow case was the case from early this year where a taxpayer had taken amounts from one IRA account and placed those back, rolled those over within 60 days, and at that time had a second separate IRA account that was in his name and took funds from that IRA account and then attempted to redeposit those within 60 days. The IRS took the position in court that you could only, we know that there is a rule that states that if you take an actual rollover, that is, you take actual cash from the account and you deposit it in a non-IRA, you take cash from the account, it comes into your hands, and then you go and try to find someplace else to put it, so you take a cash rollover, not a direct rollover, that you're only allowed to do one of those per year. The IRS publication related to IRAs, Publication 590, had an example that indicated that this was tested on a per IRA account basis, not a per IRA beneficiary basis. And Mr. Bobrow, even though he never mentioned that, was essentially using what the publication stated. The tax court held that, in fact, the clear language of the code, as the IRS was insisting in court, required that the money, that basically once you had taken money from an IRA, That rollover was going to block you from doing any other rollovers from any other IRAs you may hold until the expiration of the one-year period. Following that case, it was pointed out not only that the Publication 590 disagreed with that, but also was pointed out that these 1981 proposed regs had specifically held for the position advanced in Publication 590 that you could take it from separate accounts. In reality, Publication 590 took its examples from those proposed regs. Well, as you can imagine, it's a little bit embarrassing for the service to be in that position. So some of you may remember that in March, in Announcement 2014-15, the IRS announced that, in fact, they would not enforce this rule until the end of 2015. But nevertheless, those proposed regs were still sitting out there. This week, the IRS officially withdrew those proposed regs. So at this point, the IRS, which is going to, as they state and as they remind us in withdrawing the proposed regs, they are now going to take the position in line with the tax court that the only valid interpretation of the law says once you have done a rollover, you cannot do another rollover from any other IRA, not just that one account, for a year following that date. Chief Counsel Advice 2014-28-008, which was issued on the 11th of July, deals with a case that we run into from time to time. Taxpayer had a principal residence. Taxpayer, for some time period after leaving that residence as a principal resident, rents it out, especially during the downturn. A lot of taxpayers would do that, waiting for the market to come back. During that time period, the taxpayer has a rental that throws off losses. Now we get to, and before 3 years are up from the time we left the residence, we sell the residence. We end up triggering a gain. So there's a gain on sale of the residence. That gain is less than $250,000 if we are a single individual, $500,000 if we're married following a joint return. And so we have the option of using Section 121, which will basically make none of that gain recognized except for the post 2007 depreciation. Obviously, at this time frame, that will be all the depreciation we claim during the rental period, assuming that we took it. So the question becomes, now here's the problem. During those years with the rental, we ended up having pent-up passive losses. So we had losses from the rentals during those years. We were not able to deduct them. Now we're 3 years out. Now we're here. Before the end of the 3 years, we sell it. If we take advantage of Section 121, which tells us that the gain will not, you know, that we will not pay tax on the gain up to $250,000 or $500,000 in gain, does that block us from being able to deduct the rest of the passive losses? Because remember, there's a general rule under Section 469G that if we have a fully taxable disposition, and that is a title used in that section, that we are able to treat any losses that are in excess of our passive income for the year from that activity as not from a passive activity. So the question that was being brought up in this memo was, does electing 121 mean we cannot use the fully taxable disposition rules? And the IRS concludes in the memo that the answer to that is no, they don't. They're not blocking each other. In the memo, they concluded that 469G1A, that says about the fully taxable transaction, only applies to transactions where the gain essentially is something like a property exchange. They note that if it's a non-recognized transaction, the code section in their analysis will normally say no gain or loss shall be recognized. That's including things like a 1031 exchange. But in this case, they state that what happens is we have it realized, but we don't include it in income. In the IRS's view, we have recognized that gain, we just haven't taxed the gain. In that scenario, despite the title of fully taxable transaction in 469G1A, the IRS in this memorandum holds that in fact we do release the pent-up passive losses. The memo does make clear, however, that let's say we have excluded $100,000 of gain, you don't get to treat that as passive income to go free up other passive losses. It was not recognized since it was never picked up as income on the return. It doesn't count as passive income. But what it does tell us is we don't have to walk away or not take the 121 exclusion if we are going to want to use up those pent-up losses, or more likely, if the gain's much larger than the losses, you know, we're going to have to give up those rental losses. This particular chief counsel advice, 2014-28-008, makes clear that we can, in fact, have our cake and eat it too. If you have filed returns in the past where you believe, and the statute's still open, that you had decided to opt out of the 121 because you thought you couldn't use it, you couldn't free up the losses, or more likely, you decided to not make use of 121 and pay tax on the gain, make use of 121 but give up the losses, you may be able and probably should be able to go back and amend those returns under the logic of this ruling, and certainly file a claim and point out this particular advice and suggest that with the analysis in this device, your claim for refund should be allowed. In Chief Counsel Advice 2014-28-007, also released on July 11th, the IRS started looking at whether or not the IRS has the right to notify a withholding agent who has a W-8 ECI on file from a taxpayer, a foreign taxpayer, that in fact that taxpayer is not filing returns with the IRS, and that by not filing returns, that makes the W-8 ECI is in essence an invalid W-8 ECI, and therefore the withholding must be triggered. As you probably should be aware, under Internal Revenue Code sections 1441 and 1442, a withholding agent has to withhold 30% of any U.S. fixed or determinable annual or periodic income that's made to a foreign person, subject to withholding. However, if that income is effectively connected with a U.S. trade or business, and the holder and the recipient of that files with the withholding agent, which generally is a party paying this particular income back over, a W-8 ECI indicating that it's effectively connected and they are going to report this income on a U.S. tax return, generally the withholding requirements go away. Under the normal rules, a withholding agent can rely upon the statements on the W-8 ECI, and therefore the withholding agent does not withhold, they transmit the entire amount of funds to the recipient. At this point, they said, the exception to that is if the withholding agent has a reason to know that that claim for exemption is invalid. The second clue is, if the agent receives a notification from the IRS that the claim is invalid, the agent must begin withholding within 30 days after the IRS notifies the agent that they have an invalid claim. The question being posed in this memo by somebody in the IRS was, look, we've got this foreign taxpayer. We know they're not filing U.S. tax returns. We are aware they're receiving income from this particular withholding agent. We discovered that they have given this withholding agent W-8 ECI. That's what the withholding agent is relying upon for not withholding. Can we notify them that they're not filing the returns? And more importantly, is the fact they're not filing the returns, does that mean that the W-8 ECI exemption claim is invalid? This particular analysis takes a look at that and decides that, in fact, the W-8 ECI that is signed by the beneficial owner has language indicating that the owner is aware that they must file and they will file an annual U.S. income tax return to claim this status. The national office concludes when the beneficial owner fails to file that return with the IRS, that makes the W-8 ECI invalid. Since the IRS has the right to notify the withholding agent of the existence of an invalid W-8 ECI, the IRS will give them the notice the W-8 ECI is invalid. The withholding agent will therefore need to begin withholding within 30 days after receiving that notice that in fact the W-8 ECI is invalid. And if the withholding agent fails to withhold within those 30 days, then they can become subject to paying the tax if the tax is not actually paid. This is found with the requirements under IRC Section 1461. In this particular case, therefore, the service, having made that notification, obviously at this point they would look to the withholding agent for payment, since, as should be clear in the fact pattern that led to this memorandum, the actual owner of the property is not paying the taxes at this point because they're not actually filing the tax returns. Finally, let's go to our final one for this week. We're going to go to the case of English versus Commissioner. This was a tax court summary opinion that came down on the 10th of July, and it is TC Summary Opinion 2014-66, dealing with an interesting situation of a taxpayer who becomes disabled. In this particular case, Cheryl English had become disabled, and as is true in many cases, she had a private disability policy, and she filed, as required under the terms of that policy when it began paying out under its terms, with the Social Security Administration for disability benefits. Her policy generally provided that to the extent that she received Social Security disability payments, she had to basically reduce what she received on the private policy by that amount. The private policy payments in this fact pattern, the court didn't go into details, but we can assume that this particular policy's disability income was excludable from her income, most likely because it had been paid with after-tax dollars. So she received non-taxable disability payments from the Hartford Insurance Company. At the same time that she began receiving those payments, in 2007, she filed with Social Security. Now, as you may be aware, if you've ever been involved with a client who has filed for Social Security disability, that process can take a long time to get a decision from Social Security. And in fact, the Social Security Administration did not finally award her disability benefits until 2010. Under the terms of the Social Security Disability Program, however, if they award you such benefits, your benefits are retroactive. That goes back to the time they should have been paid under your application had they accepted the application initially. In Cheryl English's case, that meant that she received benefits of $49,610 for her prior years, and the vast majority of that, $48,144, had to be repaid to the Hartford Insurance Company. So she gets this check, the vast majority of which she ends up immediately paying back to the Hartford Insurance Company. She was paying back non-taxable disability benefits she'd received from the policy. Now, the question she wondered about was, well, this is Social Security, which is taxable if paid, generally. So, but she said, doesn't seem to be fair that I should have to pay tax on this when I'm forced to repay it, and I'm repaying amounts that were not subject to tax. But Cheryl English realized she's not a tax expert, so Cheryl went and consulted two separate CPAs. Both CPAs told her that she would not need to pay tax on these benefits. They concluded that. And a CPA, it's not clear from the decision whether or not that CPA was one of these two, but it seems likely it was, prepared Cheryl's return, did not report the income. The IRS, based on the 1099 SSA from Social Security, claimed the amount as taxable and assessed tax against Cheryl English. The tax court held that, as strange as it seems, the law has no exclusion here. While the law has an exclusion that relates to repayments of Social Security benefits, if you have to repay those based on some problem, so your Social Security payments for a year are reduced because a portion of them get repaid for Social Security to Social Security Administration, that reduces your income, but there's no equivalent provision that allows an offset for repaying private benefits, even if those benefits were non-taxable. Therefore, the court found that's how the law works, it's taxable. Now, this particular amount of income obviously put a pretty decent amount of tax on a return because as disability, quite often what we discover is if the other spouse is not disabled, this is not somebody who is living solely on disability, but rather her spouse has some income. And in fact, that $48,000 of income, even though it's Social Security, it's going to be 85% taxable and may very well constitute a significant tax due. And in this case, it cleared the $5,000 or 10% of tax properly shown on the return limits to trigger the substantial understatement penalty. The question that came before the court was, does she owe the 20% penalty? Because that's automatic generally if you have a substantial understatement. Your only out for that is to show you have substantial authority. And the court concluded that the language of the law was relatively clear. There was not substantial authority and she didn't take that position. However, if the taxpayer has behaved reasonably and essentially and attempted to properly assess her tax, then under the special rules that are involved with Section 6664C1, if she can show she acted with reasonable cause and in good faith, she doesn't owe the penalty. In this particular case, the court concluded that she sought out the advice of professionals that she reasonably believed were competent. That's one of the tests you usually have to clear. The taxpayer provides all necessary information, and the advisor is not a promoter or somebody who has a vested interest in giving a particular answer. In this case, she took the obvious step. She went and consulted not just one, but two separate tax experts. The fact they gave her the wrong answer is not necessarily relevant as long as Cheryl had no reason to believe they'd given her the wrong answer, and she had reason to believe that these people should have been able to give her the right answer. Therefore, the court found Cheryl had acted reasonably, and Cheryl did not owe the 20% penalty. This concludes this week's Federal Tax Updates from your State Society of CPAs and Nicholas Patrick CPE. Be sure and join us next week for another set of updates as we look at what the courts, the IRS, do for the following week in the area of federal taxes.